Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is Senate Ag Committee member and Minnesota Democrat Tina Smith, who joins us to discuss the reconciliation bill currently being discussed in the Senate. But first, here's this week's headlines. Ships filled with Ukrainian grain have left the port of Odessa for the first time in 5 months. Farmers are hoping to profit again, and the United Nations is hoping to see food prices drop for needy countries. Russia, Ukraine, the United Nations, and Turkey agreed to a deal in July to allow grain exports to resume from the region. That deal must be renewed by all four parties every 120 days. New numbers released this week by Purdue University and the CME Group show producers feel a little better about the current farm economy despite rising costs and sinking prices. The Ag Economy Barometer had a slight uptick in its most recent report, but the measure of farmer sentiment is still well below the score of a year ago. 42% of farmers polled say their biggest concern over the next year is higher input costs. 49% think their farming operation will be worse off next year than it is today. On Capitol Hill, Senate Democrats are eyeing action on a reconciliation bill unveiled last week. That compromise legislation would require the support of every Democrat in the chamber and can expect the opposition of all 50 of their Republican colleagues. Among the bill's $369 billion in climate-related spending are provisions to invest in some familiar agricultural conservation programs set to be reauthorized in the upcoming Farm Bill process. Minnesota Democrat Tina Smith sits on the Senate Ag Committee, which is currently in the process of oversight on the 2018 legislation. When we spoke to her, we asked her what role this reconciliation package could have on the next Farm Bill.
This Inflation Reduction Act is going to have a really significant benefit for rural communities and agriculture. Really, and there's three ways that I think it's going to make a difference. The first is the so-called climate smart agriculture, which is essentially an infusion of new dollars into the conservation programs, especially conservation programs for working land, CSP, and EQIP. Farmers know that those strategies are really good for their farming practices, and they're also really good for sequestering carbon in the soil, helping to address issues with runoff. And those programs are dramatically oversubscribed, I think something like 3 to 1. So the additional resources into those conservation programs will be really helpful. And then the second thing that's a really big deal is the big infusion of resources into rural energy and power. Now, this is something that I've worked on a lot with the REAP program, big jump in funding for those dollars, and also really great support for rural electric co-ops to help them make the transition to clean power. That's going to be good for their members and good for their ratepayers and good for the climate. And then, of course, the third thing is that we have some really good proposals in there for forestry and for kind of climate resilience. So all of these things are going to be helping folks in rural communities. And as you were asking, as to the extent that we are upping the base for conservation programs, for example, that's going to help us put together the Farm Bill next year, because we're going to start from a higher base as we put that all together.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I want to follow up specifically on some of the conservation language that you mentioned there, because this bill would, infusing that $20 billion, that's a lot of money to be added to that title in a single farm bill. Any concerns on your end about the potential precedent this might set for future farm bills, future pieces of legislation, bringing in this amount of money into that title?
Well, I think the thing about it is that, we're talking about a 10-year program, we're talking about raising the base, and we're talking about conservation programs that are significantly oversubscribed. Many more farmers want to participate in these programs than we've had dollars to allow for that. So all of that makes me feel comfortable that we are moving in the right direction, and actually moving in the direction that there's already demand for in agriculture that we just haven't been able to meet. Because as you know, when we put together the Farm Bill, we're always sort of limited. We always have a hard time growing the pie. We're often having an argument about how to divide up the pie. And I think that's why this is going to make it easier for us to come up with solutions that have good bipartisan support.
Well, and you mentioned bipartisan support. That's kind of what my next question was about, because we can't ignore the fact that this is an even numbered year. The possibility for control of the House and Senate will be decided by the American people in November. So should this package pass, the money is infused, there's that level of additional support for the conservation program. Do you think that additional support has a sufficient level of bipartisan backing to survive a potential change in control in the Senate?
Well, I mean, we'll see. The reason I feel optimistic about it is that, first of all, let's remember that this is all paid for. And so this is the overall package is a deficit reduction package. So to start to unwind that, I don't know why you would want to do that when, not only are these conservation programs really powerful, not only are the energy programs really popular in red states and blue states, but also it's paid for. And it's, to be really clear, because there's been some misinformation out there, it's paid for without raising taxes on anybody making less than $400,000 a year or on companies. So it is not going to affect farmers unless if you happen to be a farm that's making more than $1 billion in profit, then I guess maybe it might have an impact on you. But so that's why I'm optimistic. And as you know, these farm bills don't tend to be partisan so much as they are regional in terms of working out some of the regional differences that that we have in this country around agriculture.
We'll be right back to talk farm bill, biofuels policy, and more with Senator Smith right after this.
It's not as simple just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back. Many of the Democratic Party are pushing for the electrification of the nation's vehicle fleet, but the Inflation Reduction Act does include tax credits for the biofuels industry. Senator Tina Smith says it's important for both electrification and biofuels to receive support.
I think that we should not get in the mindset of thinking that that biofuels, ethanol, biodiesel, and advanced biofuels are automatically in competition with electrification, because we need to, of course, we understand two things. One, people are going to be driving liquid fuel-based vehicles for a long, 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 long time, whether it's cars or trucks, or whether we're talking about, farm implements that people are using. Second of all, there is a real advantage in upping the content of biofuels and liquid fuel. That is good for American agriculture. It's very good for my home state of Minnesota, and it's good for the carbon impact of those fuels. So we are always pushing to up that content. I mean, I'd like to see us getting certainly, year-round E15, getting up to E85. I mean, that's why the investment that we make in the Inflation Reduction Act in infrastructure for biofuels is really, really important, so that people have the opportunity, those blending pumps and other infrastructure that we need. And then there's one other thing that I think is really important, which is the bill makes significant investments in terms of tax credits for carbon capture. And this is going to be a potential big benefit for ethanol and other biofuels plants that are looking to figure out how they can economically capture that carbon and potently even pipe that, pipe that good someplace where it can be used in another way, which would be another income stream. There's Project Tundra in Minnesota that is looking at how to accomplish that in Minnesota, North Dakota.
Simply stated, Senator Smith, is the Inflation Reduction Act going to pass?
This is going to pass. It's going to pass in the coming days. I'm very optimistic about this. And I think it's going to make a big difference for lowering prices for consumers and helping support the strong energy. Rural energy is clean energy. And to be able to support that in this bill, along with the conservation programs, is a big deal.
Okay. We've talked about it kind of in the context of the reconciliation package, but I want to drill down a little bit on the farm bill and your preparation for it. Wondering the conversations that you have with producers in your home state about the 18 farm bill. What are you hearing in terms of their reaction, their working with that 18 bill, and how is that going to influence your approach to the 2023 legislation?
Yeah, well, so the Minnesota Farm Fest has been going on right now. I've been here in Washington, but I was just checking in with people about what folks have been talking about. A lot of focus on the Farm Bill coming up in 2023. And we've been doing a lot of preparation this year, a lot of conversations, roundtables, and discussions across the gamut to understand what's on people's minds about it. I mean, certainly there is a big focus on crop insurance right now, and I completely get that as we are seeing increasing issues with droughts and extreme weather events. Drought is an issue in Minnesota, as it was in, you know, last year as well. So we're hearing about that. Also hearing about how important it is to give the Secretary of Agriculture some flexibility in how, and ability to make some decisions about how some of the conservation programs are implemented to account for producers that are dealing with drought situations. Of course, Minnesota is a big sugar beet state. And so there's always interest and attention in protecting the sugar program, which has been such a successful program. And then maybe the last thing I'll mention is that there has always farmers are thinking about succession planning and what's going to happen next. And especially as the average age of Minnesota farmers is about 56, 57, there's always a lot of discussion about what we can do to help new and beginning farmers come into this field. There are a lot of barriers, but it's a great way of life and a great business, and how to support some of those beginning and new farmer programs.
So certainly a long list of items to discuss for the upcoming Farm Bill, a long list of impacts that this Inflation Reduction Act could have on that upcoming Farm Bill. Senator Smith, we appreciate your time to discuss it all.
Well, thanks so much, Spencer. It's great to be with you.
We'll be right back to hear from this week's panel. But first, our Hannah Pagel takes a look at a growing conservation program in this week's Map It Out.
Since its inception in 1985, the Conservation Reserve Program has long been viewed as a way to take land out of commodity production. But recent increases in acres of grassland CRP may signal a new era for the program, adding more of a working lands element to it. Farmers who enroll in grassland CRP receive a smaller payment than what they would get if they enrolled in traditional CRP, which would take the land completely out of production. But with grassland CRP, farmers are allowed to graze the land, cut it for hay, or use it for seed production in addition to receiving a payment for taking it out of production agriculture. Last month, the Department of Agriculture approved an additional 3.1 million acres of grassland CRP, bypassing last year's total of 2.5 million acres by 22%. Colorado led all states with 642,000 acres, followed by South Dakota with 425,000 acres, and Nebraska with 422,000. Steve Davies has a deeper look at the situation and the possible Farm Bill implications of the growth of grassland CRP in his story on AgriPulse.com. For this week's Map It Out, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we're excited to be joined by this week's panel, joined today by Rob LaRue of the National Farmers Union, as well as Kurt Kovarik from the Clean Fuels Alliance America. Gentlemen, appreciate the time. And Rob, I want to go to you first, because obviously there's a massive piece of legislation currently on the agenda in the United States Senate. Wondering if maybe before we dive into the specifics of the agricultural, the climate smart agricultural language in there, wondering if you could just take a step back and say what you're going to be watching as you track the bill's prospects to actually end up on President Joe Biden's desk. What are you going to be watching for some of those key signals?
Well, I think there's actually, you know, a couple of things. We're obviously in communication with the House right now to get a feel for the level of support there. There's also obviously a couple of very key members of the Senate. And although there's a lot of discussion right now about the only Democrat support around this and so forth, I think we'll also be looking for any kind of breaks in some bipartisan support here, because certainly a lot of the investment that is in this package is both really important to Democrats and to Republicans. We're not in a season where bipartisanship, even on a good day, is something that we normally see in D.C., but we're hoping that we'll begin to see just a little bit of movement that way so that the bill can successfully make its way through.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if it were to make its way through, Rob, one of the things, one of the provisions in there is a decent amount of money for conservation programs that are, you know, pretty popular in many parts of farm country. A lot of infusion into, you know, what some people would view as the conservation title of the farm bill. And with that 2023 farm bill, potentially, you know, the farm bill being drafted, oversight conducted right now, wondering, that infusion of money into that conservation title, should it happen, does that make it easier or harder to perhaps maybe add some new money to other titles, namely conservation programs and so many groups calling for higher reference prices? Does this bill make that easier or harder, do you think?
I don't know that I have a clean answer on whether or not it'll make it easier or harder. Certainly, as you and anybody who's been tracking farm bills over the course of many, many years, each farm bill is always a little bit different and unique, whether we're talking about a super committee process and trying to, you know, come up with other pots of money and savings and timing shift. There's always been gimmicks tied to this. I think really the focus here, first and foremost, is this historic investment in conservation spending. We know that the very popular programs entitled to those voluntary incentive-based conservation programs like EQIP, like CSP, and many others are hugely popular, never have enough funding. And so this investment would be a huge move forward there. I think that having this investment of cash now certainly isn't a bad thing. We strongly support it. But the effect that it may have on the farm bill, I think is a very a tough thing to measure right now, because I think that when we get to the farm bill, nobody ever wants to be in a conversation about taking from one title or into another. And so I think certainly we want to make sure that there is sufficient investment also in Title I in safety net programs like crop insurance and so forth, making sure that nutrition is taken care of. So I think those conversations shouldn't be necessarily tied up right now in a conversation about looking at this historic investment in many of these programs, including Title II conservation programs.
Mm-hmm. Kurt, I want to bring you into the fold here, because there's also some language in this bill looking at tax credits for the biodiesel industry, the biofuels industry as a whole, really. But we have seen, and this is going back really to the Build Back Better days when this package took that nomenclature, but we're seeing some level of disagreement within the industry, specifically when you bring in the truck stop folks into the equation. Wondering how you think the industry will go about navigating those difficulties, navigating that uncertainty as this package is considered.
Sure, glad to be with you. You know, this has been a long process. This has been, you know, a year and a half of engagement with the Hill, a bill that started off at $3.5 trillion. The one before us is now just shy of $1 trillion. You know, our motivation in this all along has been, if you're going to put forward policies that address climate, energy independence, and homegrown energy, then biodiesel, renewable diesel, sustainable aviation fuel need to be a strong component of that. That it shouldn't be just electric vehicles or just new technologies coming down the road. There are existing technologies like biodiesel, renewable diesel, and sustainable aviation fuel that are delivering, you know, homegrown gallons of low carbon fuels today that are adding to the value of America's farmers. With respect to what's in this bill, you know, our provisions have always been supported by Republicans and Democrats. Historically, the biodiesel tax credit, the renewable fuel standard, other policies that our industry has advocated for have always received bipartisan support, and that continues today. So we looked at this as an opportunity that if clean energy was going to be a component, we wanted to be in it. We're in it with a two-year extension. Our blender's tax credit expires at the end of this year. So it's nice to see if this ultimately gets across the finish line in the way that it's packaged right now, that will provide certainty for us before our tax credit expires, which is exciting and hasn't happened in a while. So that would give the industry certainty through 2024 and 2025. I think what the truck stops are concerned about are two items. One is that it converts our tax credit ultimately at the end of the day to a credit for domestic production. That has been something that they've fought vigorously for more than a decade. And then I think they also have concerns in my view, might be a little bit over-exaggerated or misplaced with respect to the incentives for sustainable aviation fuel. I'm not going to speak for them. That's the two primary areas that they've expressed concerns. We look at this as a good opportunity for our producers, soybean farmers, to continue to grow feedstocks for low carbon biofuels, whether that's for biodiesel in heavy duty trucking, renewable diesel that ends up in California or elsewhere, or sustainable aviation fuel, which is in high demand right now.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back. The Inflation Reduction Act, currently before the United States Senate, includes some major tax credits for the biofuels industry. Kirk Kovarik is a lobbyist with Clean Fuels Alliance America, and he said those tax credits could lead to some big benefits for producers across the country.
The good news in this bill and with recent policies through EPA is that they're taking opportunities to send market signals to whether it's the farmer, the other feedstock providers, or the producers of the fuel. You know, our fuel goes into, if you think about the distillate pool, you know, sustainable aviation fuel is one, but heavy duty trucking, farm equipment, construction, and home heating. There's an enormous drive to replace dirty oil heat use in the Northeast with clean burning bioheat, which is a mixture of biodiesel and traditional oil heat. You know, if you look at the likelihood of electrification or decarbonization through other means in those sectors, it's hard to see that developing, you know, overnight, much less in a decade or two or three, and some of them probably never. So our view is, as long as there's signals sent to the industry and to the market, there's going to be an opportunity for the fuel to be used for each of the fuels, biodiesel, renewable diesel, and sustainable aviation fuel. And if you think about what's going on in the industry right now with respect to feedstock supplies. You mentioned, are we going to have enough? In recent months, we've seen about $4.5 billion worth of new soybean crush announcements throughout the entire upper Midwest. That to us is, you know, it's not entirely driven by the demand for the vegetable oil, but I don't think those announcements would be made if we weren't adding significant value to that vegetable oil through the production of biodiesel and renewable diesel. So, you know, if in terms of what it means for a farmer, you know, it's, in my view, it's much better to have that soybean go 30 miles down the road and be crushed there and add value to that product, you know, whether it's in North Dakota or Minnesota or Missouri or Kentucky or Louisiana, for that matter, rather than exporting it. We're certainly not opposed to exports, but to the extent that we can add value to that commodity here in the United States by crushing it here, taking the oil, turning it into a low carbon biofuel, and providing even more quantity and affordability to soybean meal for livestock production, we think is certainly a win-win. And that's the result of these kind of forward-looking policies that we've been working with the EPA and Congress on.
Mm-hmm. And I'll wrap things up with you here, Rob. If you'll indulge some hypothetical pessimism on my part, let's say for the sake of argument that this bill, something happens and it's not able to get across the finish line. That new money that potentially could be added into the farm bill doesn't happen. Absent this legislative package, this reconciliation package, what does the prospect for new money in the upcoming farm bill look like in your mind?
Boy, I really appreciate you throwing me all the easy questions here. again, as a survivor of many farm bill process and so forth, it's way too early, right? We'll see what the CBO kind of estimate is, you know, when we get to that point. That'll kind of gauge what the lay of the land is across all the titles in the programs. But I think that it would certainly be a missed opportunity to not at least envision a farm bill that has the level of investments in Title I for commodity programs, for climate smart agriculture, for those conservation programs, and energy and trade and so forth, and build a bill as best we can around that, as opposed to simply starting with an assumption that we either need to find additional savings, as we've, you know, unfortunately done in some farm bills in the past, or that there's just simply no new money, and then you end up with these inner fights here. So I think we should focus on what the needs are right now, and then we've been creative in the past. We can certainly be creative in the future, kind of finding how to make those investments possible. This is a good start, though, with the Inflation Reduction Act, and certainly hope that we see action on it.
Well, and that action will be something that we'll be watching for here in the coming days, coming weeks. Obviously, a lot that we'll be keeping an eye on when it relates to this package on Capitol Hill. But I think that's going to do it for today. So, Rob, Kurt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Glad to be with you.
We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, our Hannah Pegel takes a look at farm size statistics in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
As American agriculture changes with time and innovation, family farms have also continued to evolve. In the last several decades, new innovations and technologies have enabled farmers to scale up and manage more acres. USDA's Economic Research Service categorizes farms as low risk if they have an operating profit margin greater than 25%. An operating profit margin is the ratio of operating profit to gross farm income. This chart shows a breakdown of these low-risk farms based on their size. According to ERS figures, large-scale family farms are more likely to have stronger financial performances than other farms. Large family farms are defined as operations with a gross cash farm income of $1 million or more. In 2020, these farms made up 3% of the total U.S. farms, but contributed to 46% of the value of production that year. Since 2019, non-family farms with high profit margins have increased significantly. You can see that from the dark blue line here. Finally, a growing share of small family farmers, or those with a gross income less than $350,000, are operating with profit margins that put them outside the ERS low-risk category. For this week's Ag by the Numbers, I'm Hannah Pegel.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the next week. We'll be watching the Senate for their work on the Inflation Reduction Act reconciliation package. If the upper chamber clears the bill, House leadership could reconvene during the August recess to try and send it to President Joe Biden's desk. There's also the release of a new consumer price index scheduled for Wednesday. Meanwhile, our Noah Wicks will be at the American Coalition for Ethanol's annual conference in Nebraska starting on Wednesday. As always, keep an eye on AgriPulse.com for the latest farm policy news in Washington and across the country. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.